Hi, welcome to Byzantine Dreams with Michael and Carolyn.
Today, we're broadcasting with Amber Balde, one of our favorite voices and humans in privacy, the digital self, and decentralized tech. For those who don't know, Amber is co-founder and CEO of Clover, board member of the Zcash Foundation, and has dyed her hair all the colors I've been secretly scared to sample myself. Amber has deep roots in New York's hacker, maker, and merry prankster subcultures, as well as the FOSS, or free and open source software, community. She came to rise as the unlikely humanizing face during the last bull market of JP Morgan's blockchain initiatives.
And ironically enough, we recorded this episode the same day it was announced that Consensus would be taking over Quorum, a private implementation of Ethereum that Amber helped spearhead at JPM. A happy marriage of our former employers and former lives. So Amber, Michael, and I peel back the curtain in this episode, and we take a sober look at the dystopian state of our digital world 30 years past the crypto wars. And we ask, where can we carve out hope in building healthier financial and communication systems? We begin by delving into the crisis in Belarus, the legacy of the cypherpunks, the human costs of surveillance capitalism, how we can hijack the cloud, and most importantly, Amber's sweet gaming rig. So let's do it. This is episode 3 of Byzantine Dreams.
Welcome everyone to the third episode of Byzantine Dreams. Today we are talking to Amber Balde.
Hi, that's me.
That's right. So today is a perfect day to have you on. We had the biggest news of 2016 break today, which is that Consensus Systems has acquired the IP for Quorum from JP Morgan. Any hot takes on your former employers joining forces?
I mean, my 2016 self is extremely excited about it. I think that that's great for Quorum, good for them, and it's good for the entire ecosystem to have good technical stewards of an open source code base. So absolutely, go for it.
Yeah, exciting news. I think the work with Quorum is probably how we first met, Amber, back when I was at Consensus in, like you said, 2016. I think today we're going to get way deeper on some of this like hacker culture, cypherpunk stuff. But before we get lost there, I wanted to take a quick detour. What's your take on what's happening in Belarus, and why do you think it's kind of coming to a head here in 2020?
I mean, 2020 is definitely a moment. It's like no one wants to know what the final boss of 2020 is going to be. At this point, I think, what we see in Belarus could really be any country. And what you're referring to is that there is a disputed election, and in process of the dispute to, quote unquote, keep the streets safe and protect the populace, the internet has been basically shut down. And so people cannot communicate internally or externally with their friends and families, which means you also can't coordinate protests and you can't get external news. Pretty dark stuff. The way that they have shut down the internet isn't that it's shut down. It's just that, traffic is being sinkholed to specific places and filtered. And that's something that happens every couple of years, sometimes by accident, sometimes intentionally. It's often hard to tell the difference. I think Belarus is claiming that they're under a massive denial of service attack,
right.
But there's not really external evidence of that necessarily. It's probably more likely that they're routing traffic through their own kind of packet filters and all this stuff. But, what they're referring to is like the low level kind of backbone routing of the internet uses, called BGP routing. And every kind of prefix of the IP addresses that you're familiar with is supposed to be controlled by a variety of kind of autonomous systems. And they all broadcast where they are and what internet traffic they can route where. We kind of trust what they say they're able to route. And so if you make a false declaration saying, hey, I can actually handle all the traffic of YouTube, YouTube's over here, then all of a sudden all of the traffic of YouTube gets routed to you. And I think that that happened a couple of years ago. YouTube was down for a while because, you know, there's a country that was falsely advertising that they were the BGP destination for YouTube. And it turned out that they were a country that actually just wanted to censor YouTube traffic, and they kind of did it in a ham-handed way. So it happens over and over, and we've known about that since the 90s, but there's not a particularly elegant solution. And the problem really is that when some packets are not free, then none of them are free. And, you know, it's hard to maintain a decentralized system where parts of it try to become controlled through a central point.
Totally. Moving the frame back a little bit, I hate to say it, almost feels kind of quaint compared to the existential battle to the death we find ourselves in now. What seems to have changed?
It's a great question. You know, from my perspective, it seems that for a long time, hackers were kind of individual actors, or you know, loosely coordinated kind of groups and like smaller collectives, and people saw corporations as being the bad guys and the enemies more so than attacks on specific governments. You know, there's always the kind of cyber war thing that people talked about going on in the background. But I think most people were, it wasn't like where the main kind of hacker wars were and like what you were owning up and what you were focused on. Then after the Snowden leaks, there became so much focus and attention on what the government has actually been doing and what kind of intelligence projects around the world were extant, that the focus kind of shifted. The whole kind of ethos changed. And from there, it has become, there's much more of a focus on, you know, what people throw around the term APTs or advanced persistent threats, but nation state kind of cyber war from there. And against that entire specter, we've had kind of both the open source movement that we can talk about later, but also the rise of kind of surveillance capitalism and the breakdown of a free and open internet. And it really is just this, I don't think anything's a perfect storm, but it's a bunch of disparate threads, any one of which could have gone a different way, but all of which in our timeline happened to converge on, you know, we're basically building the dystopia we want to see in the world.
Okay, so you made an interesting point here, which is that like we're kind of like building the dystopia that we all saw coming. So let's start to like rewind a little bit here. We want to go back in time a little bit. And I think like the most interesting way to pull that thread is to talk about your co-founder's experience with Satoshi's mail on the Cypherpunk mailing list.
Sure. Yeah, it isn't a fun anecdote we pull out at parties frequently. So I guess in 2008, you know, he was on the MetzDAO mailing list. It's one of the cryptography mailing lists. There are a handful. And, you know, read the early, the first Satoshi mailing about Bitcoin linking to the paper. And he's like, what is this? This is dumb. Delete.
Wow.
You know, I mean, which I also, you know, read the white paper in 2010, and because everybody wouldn't stop bugging me about it. I was like, okay, well, now I know what that is. You know, it was just an ongoing fun kind of hacker topic and joke. I remember watching it hit a dollar and being like, holy cow, dollar parody. You know, but none of us are, you know, I'm not living on a yacht somewhere, because I never I never thought about this as an investment vehicle. It was always about what they were trying to achieve, what the purpose and the goals for a wider society where personal agency and control of data, communication, privacy, and liberty for all was, you know, what it was supposed to be about. And the side joke of that is like, yeah, let's get everybody to use PGP. Like, that's never worked either. So, you know, it has always just seemed like a fun.
We're working
side
on
project.
It.
No, you know, I still get
Casa R&D. Yeah.
You know, I get emails now from you know, journalists working on sensitive projects, and they're like, you know, can I contact you? I can send you my PGP key. Or and I'm like, well, do you want to just contact me on Signal? And they're like, oh, thank you. It's like the one thing everybody loves, but nobody wants to use. But someday, someday.
I've seen a prominent Bitcoiner doing autographs with his PGP key.
That's cool.
Yeah. Cool. I saw there was, I think, Jan Bcrypt on Twitter. I had posted a cryptographer bingo that was like one of the spots was like you went to a key signing party in 2017. Or like you have your PGP key like posted publicly, like, you know, you have feelings about it was a great bingo card. I recommend you look it up, put that in the show notes.
That's awesome. All right. Tell us a little bit about like your history with hacker subculture.
So when I moved to New York, I got involved in some of the hacker spaces that I mentioned. And through that, I really just, you know, made friends. You go to meetups and you talk to people and you meet people you keep in touch with and you end up sometimes seeing them at conferences. You end up bumping into them at parties. You end up seeing them at protests or possibly getting arrested. You do their prison support. And, you know, there's certainly a sense of community there. And from that, everybody's working on different projects with different visions and in different spaces. And it's really the diversity of ideas and news that you get that's really fun. And so I got to hear a lot of things before they broke in the press. And it was really an interesting time to see. It's one of those times I think, like, you know, doctors read the news and you realize just how broken all of the medical reporting is. Like you no longer trust the news after you see your specific field mentioned there. So once you're in tech and then you read tech news, you realize that all of the tech news is completely broken. So you start to read these news articles about some of the kind of popularized hacker events and data breaches and things. You're like, wow, they got this so wrong. And it just kind of undermines your trust in journalism in general, but they're trying, they're doing their best. And some people really do put the time in. So don't want to bash the media. We need them. Fourth estate. Mm.
So speaking of some of the maker culture, being able to do stuff from scratch, you know, you touched on early cryptography, PGP, and I think some of our listeners are pretty familiar with that stuff because it does have, you know, the direct lineage to Bitcoin, the Cyberpunk mailing list. But I'd be interested to hear you talk a little bit about FOSS and more the open source software side of InfoSec, of tech, and your background there, and how you think about that and your approaches with your work.
Yeah, the entire kind of open source revolution has really changed what it's like to get into technology and to become a developer these days, along with the other thing that has changed that is like the endless JavaScript frameworks. It's like,
you gotta delint.
Oh my God. It's turtles all the way down. But I think that what has been an important catalyst has been, for better or worse, corporate input in open source. Hmm. You see the largest contributors to Linux continuing to be companies like Oracle, and they couldn't survive without that. So that has been, you know, people bemoan what's the monetization model of open source, but it, you know, right now a lot of the monetization model is, are you an employee at one of these companies that lets you work on a major open source project? That's not helpful to people that want to build standalone, delightful open source tools and get them out to the world. That's something, you know, that we care a lot about at Clover, actually. There's a huge gap in there that we need to continue to bridge, and you can just call it UX, you can call it usability, but it's not just that. It's really complex and unforgiving and awful plumbing and gluing of components and pieces and things that create something that becomes a delightful experience. So people can now, you know, distribute and use these applications. And so I think that's an awesome thing to work on. And that was actually like a side niche plug for my co-founder, Patrick, who in addition to being awful at reading Satoshi's emails, is designing and building a lot of that sort of glue, and is just doing such a great job of building the internet he wants to see in the world. So props.
No, totally. I mean, anytime you're starting a new web dev project, it is like 95 minutes of okay, get my Redux stored, like get it yarn. All right, hold on, blah, blah, blah.
Yeah, so I didn't actually tell you to give me a segue to plug our public beta, but feel free. So the first application that that runs on top of the Clover framework, which is this kind of underlying orchestration tooling I was talking about, is called Clover Code, and it is basically remote development that does what you're talking about there. So you can drop in a URL to any Git repo. You can select an image to go with that or an environment. So if it's in JavaScript, maybe that's the image you want to grab. If it's in, you know, Haskell or Ruby or something else, there's images for that. You can make your own, whatever. And then it just kind of clones and runs VS Code for you in the browser. All of the more heavyweight components that would normally be in a SaaS provider's cluster somewhere off in the sky are deployed onto a VPS that you control. And that is private to you. So all of the communication happens directly between your browser and that VPS. So Clover never intermediates any of your credentials, none of your code, none of your API tokens. It's private. It feels like SaaS, but it's, you know, it's yours. And so, yeah, you can save yourself that 90 minutes, you know, create an environment you like, clone it for your next project or flip between projects, what have you. It saves people a lot of time, but you can do like heavyweight development where you need a compiler like on a Chromebook on the beach because it's running on the web. So, yeah, I guess that's the plug. I'm super excited about it. And it's just, I'm sorry it's not a Bitcoin node or whatever it is people wanted me to host. But you can do that too. That's another thing you can host, but I don't want to conflate the issue.
Does your team have the one, like, not your, I don't know, not your repo, not your...
oh, God, I should. No, it is neat to see with, and this is part of the open source story, is, like, Microsoft has totally 180'd on their idea of open source, right? Mm-hmm. And they've... and VS Code, a lot of people are standardizing on VS Code as their IDE, their integrated development environment. It's nice to use. It's good. It's a good product. They open sourced that, and they continue to add pretty robust features there. But at the same time, their idea of running that as a SaaS sort of experience is that all of your projects are then hosted in Azure. And you don't get a choice on that. Alternatively, you know, GitHub also is like, we're going to take VS, because Microsoft bought GitHub, as background, in case you missed that piece of news. They own the largest library of open source software in the world.
Also the best social network in the world.
Yeah, true. You know, and unless your coding project is based in Iran, in which case you just got dropped and can no longer access your repos.
Whoops.
Yeah, problem. So, you know, GitHub similarly was like, we could have VS Code that runs in the browser thanks to Microsoft. You can connect to any project on GitHub, but you can deploy to any cloud. So you can see that each kind of entity just says, like, what's my space that I need to make that the sticky part of the experience, but everything else can be, quote unquote, open and, like, vendor interoperable. And, you know, I'm sure these will be interesting kind of solutions people can choose. Similarly, there's other people that are trying to do online browser-based IDEs, but it completely runs in their startup kind of Kubernetes cluster. And that means that anything that you have, your startup's million-dollar baby code, you just gave, like, your OAuth credentials for your GitHub account to some other startup. Like, maybe not kosher. So disintermediating that, people talk a lot about decentralization and privacy, but like, what does that actually look like in service of the people that need it, where it's protective to them? It doesn't, you know, it doesn't have to look like sending everything over like zero knowledge tokens. Like, it doesn't need to be that complicated. It does mean that there are certain design choices that you need to make that ensure that you yourself as a service provider are not in control or in touch with customer data. I think Signal is an example of another app that has actually done a really good job of that. You can see, like, when they've been subpoenaed for information and they were asked to turn over user logs, like, they just didn't have the data. And that's a choice that very few companies make.
Yeah, that's what our stance has been during, you know, when we're talking to investors and they're asking for diligence. We say, look, we just don't have the data. I'm sorry.
Well, yeah,
you don't have it, all right?
It makes it awful because then people are like, well, give me metrics on your users. And I'm like, well, I can tell you how many like downloads of the app there are, but I can't tell you recurring users every day because I don't know.
Yeah, the disintermediation stuff is important. If I can like wax transcendentalist a bit, I think there's like a larger arc, and maybe we'll come to this later, where I feel like, I don't know, this just becomes so important when more and more human life takes place in like digital surrounds mm-hmm. that someone can't pull the plug on the substrate through which you're interacting with other human beings, right? Like if I'm in a room talking to you in person, obviously we're doing this online right now, but if I'm in like a room on the street talking to you in person, like Google doesn't own the air that my like vocal cords are vibrating to communicate with you, right? But like that's the context we're in digitally.
I do joke about Amazon creating Amazones that we all need to like request permission to leave your Amazone to travel to another one.
That's why they call it Amazon, is because the fulfillment centers, the roofs are all going to become green roofs, and they'll collectively be larger than the Amazon rainforest.
Yeah. Oh yeah.
Well, that would be good. I mean, you know, Amazon's fine. But yeah, I mean, how close are we to the, you know, the kind of digital feudalism becoming this kind of physical space feudalism again?
So, this might be a good time to talk about, so who wants to define surveillance capitalism?
Out of the people that are here right now? Sure. I'll raise my hand. It's actually kind of funny that people have associated me with talking about surveillance capitalism. Just being plugged in pretty early on to people that were talking about how problematic it is to be creating these kind of walled gardens and then trapping people, a captive audience, and monetizing their existence by finding out what they want, what they really, really want, and then marketing it back to them. Which is in essence surveillance capitalism, but you know, more so than just what we see in like Shoshana Zuboff's book and how people are talking about it quite publicly right now, which is great. It's great to people for to see people realize that like if you're not paying for it, you are the product. That's a fantastic realization. But it's also worth realizing that, you know, people say if I'm not doing anything wrong, then I have nothing to hide and I don't care what the government knows about me. You know, at the same time, they're like, the government doesn't need or doesn't get this information. We have all of these kind of, you know, arguments about protections of how much data gets handed to various government agencies here and abroad. But the thing to realize is that if you signed a TOS, some terms of service for a just a regular kind of corporate website or some fun, you know, web 2 or 3.0 site that you're on, they're able to sell that data in any way that they like. There's no longer like a warrant restriction to accessing that data. The government, why would the government get a warrant? They just buy it. So you have entities like Palantir and other companies in that space that aggregate a lot of data and have come up with much more interesting ways to monetize it than simply trying to, you know, sell you the best therapeutic pillow. Again, you know, most people don't feel this in their daily life because mm-hmm. and it becomes very much like what me worry, like I'm not doing anything wrong. But it is the slippery slope that we've talked about with, you know, Belarus, with, you know, if you thought it was okay to surveil Black Lives Matter protesters, do you also think it's okay to surveil anti-mask protesters? Like a lot of times people think it's acceptable or preventing domestic terrorism when it's the people that they disagree with. But very quickly, if you disagree with these free speech protections for people that you disagree with, then they come for you.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's also a question of like how shaped is the world that you're living in. Prior to say 2015, I don't remember retargeting being as blatant as it is now, right? I don't remember like a friend of mine looking at bicycle helmets and then suddenly being like barraged on YouTube.
But, yeah, it's creepy. I mean, people don't like feeling creeped out. Like they feel like they talk about something and then they see a Facebook ad for it and they're not sure if like they're being listened to now. And that upsets them. But you know, how many degrees away from each of us is someone who actually does have a sensitive concern or is a journalist or does have sensitive corporate information? And, you know, whether it's corporate espionage of knowing where people are at what time and being able to ascertain what's going to happen in a quarterly report based on what somebody buys in their coffee to, you know, like all these kind of cool spy stories to dissident journalists that have really real concerns about their own personal safety. We're all connected in this, let's call it a worldwide web of information and relationships. And I never want to be the weakest link in my friend's safety. I know you talk a lot about these ideas of personal liberty, but you can't just do it by yourself without actually dropping off the grid into kind of, you know, your Faraday cage in a cave somewhere, because we are connected and we end up compromising each other. So that's a reason to kind of help everybody create this kind of herd immunity and create these kind of like agitation responses where we need to expel bad ideas, because it protects everyone from any one of us when it's your turn to be the dissident.
That's really interesting. Can you talk a little bit about, let's just call it like the OPSEC herd immunity thesis? Because I'm so far in my day-to-day concerns on the sort of individualist framing of that, right?
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Like we literally sell Faraday products, right? And
yeah.
And they're adorable and important. And a lot of what we do is try to make that like accessible and lovable and cute and productized.
But it's for a very specific type of customer. I think like Amber mentioned, your average person is like, I don't have anything to hide. Why do I need these special privacy products? And it's a question I think about all the time. Are we sort of at a hopeless point, or is there, I don't know, some sort of inflection point where you can get this immunity and you can educate people? And, you know, just, what is it going to take to get people to care?
I think that the largest failing of the whole cypherpunk endeavor has been trying to educate people and get them to care. I don't know if that's optimistic or pessimistic, but I think that as an application developer, the most important thing that we can do is make good choices on their behalf in the background. And a perfect example of that is something like Let's Encrypt, that has brought the amount of SSL or TLS encrypted traffic on the internet up from whatever 40% or whatever it was before they allowed you to self-sign CAs in like 60 seconds up to over 80% encrypted traffic on the internet. And that's something that happens in the background, that people that do not know what encryption is visit these websites and get the benefit of that every day. It happens when companies like Zoom say that they're going to offer end-to-end encryption, and then they one day decide that it's only going to be a paid feature. So, you know, as free plebs aren't able to access security, it's paid feature. Security is a paid feature, is like always a fail. And secondly, it's opt-in. So even if they offer it, you need to go in for every conversation and turn it on. Facebook does the same thing. Facebook implemented fantastic encryption. It's the same encryption that's in Signal for bilateral conversations. But every conversation, you have to go in and turn it on. And people don't do that. So the default choices that you make, being very opinionated, that has more impact on mass general people's lives than trying to get them all to remember to flick the switch each time. In my humble opinion.
Yeah. I mean, there's like the plausible deniability switch, which is, I think, what you're talking about.
Well, I mean, yeah.
Well, it's an option. It's off by default, but they can turn it on.
Right, exactly. Because more than 90% of people will not change defaults, especially when the default is something like end-to-end encryption. And my mom is like, the what? No, she's not going to go turn that on. But if I just tell her, Mom, you know, download this specific app and I'll talk to you on that, and all the choices have been made for her, it's great. You know, we talk a lot about agency and giving people choice, and that is important. And having the choice does matter, but being able to prepare people by having, you know, rational, good for them choices kind of pre-selected is great. But you have to have like a good archetype for like who is the user of this product, and they might not know what their threat model is, but what can I ascertain about what's realistically a threat model for them? You know, so for example, you know, if I have a information stored on my local device, is it possible that my user is a woman who has an abusive partner, or a person, I guess, who has an abusive partner? But statistically, is it is this someone who is going to be able to secure her own device, or is there some choice that I can make here so that when you know, when this setting is changed, what happens if a confirmation email is fired about that? Is it good? You know, like, let's say that to give a concrete example, I used to work with a suicide crisis intervention kind of agency, or organization that you would do crisis chat over, text chat. And they would send an email, 2 weeks later because they wanted to make sure people were okay. And it turned out that, I asked them, like, have you considered that this person's email is likely compromised by their partner and that they might not have control of it, and that receiving the email that discloses that they were reaching out for help is actually a risk to them. And, you know, they just hadn't really considered that that was a threat vector for them. And so they, all the cryptography in the world isn't going to change that somebody that you live with has physical access to your devices. So you have to instead kind of think about user archetypes. You have to have an idea of what the threat landscape looks like for people. And you have to just kind of, there's a certain amount of empathy involved in identifying who could use your product. And all products kind of start out with the idea of like this, who's the ideal user? And, it's user-centered design. You know, they always tell you to solve problems that are closest to your heart and closest to your understanding. And it's, this is one reason why we have so many of the same problems for the same people solved over and over, when there's like tons of other really great problems out there that, people aren't working on. And, it's technical colonialism to kind of go in and try to solve these people's problems on their behalf. It's much better to be able to empower people to create and solve their own problems. And so it's awesome to see so much more focus on getting underrepresented founders funded and getting them visibility. But there's a lot of visibility. There are not as many checks. It is still very, it's still very painful process. VCs are always like, disrupt the thing. So, disrupting VC, I think, would be a really cool thing to do. But I'm not going to do it. I'm disrupting the internet.
Yeah, well, okay. So let's actually get back to that. I mean, We always have a facetious question, which is, Amber, how can blockchain save us?
How does blockchain fix it? Does it?
Right. Well, I don't, I've never believed that blockchain fixes much of anything. And I keep threatening to put together clips of me saying blockchain doesn't solve this, like in every single presentation I've ever done since 2017. Because people, like, there's still literally an article where the title of it is like, Amber Balde says blockchain can save us all. And I'm like, no, I literally said that's not the case. But there are enough.
It's the part of you deny it, Amber.
Oh my God. Regardless, I think it's important that there are people that are working on a number of different decentralized projects. Am I working on a decentralized project? Yes. Does it require that you run a specific node that runs a specific protocol? No, but we absolutely can help you run that. So there's a lot of work to do around making other decentralized kind of things more usable so that people can use them, can build on them, can communicate with them. I guess your larger question was like, how does changing internet infrastructure change the world? I think that we are mostly stuck with things as like at scale as the way that they kind of are. We've seen these large trends over the last 15 years where things have moved to public clouds. And there is no reversing that. But we can leverage the hardware where it sits to run smaller bits of things, to run containers in the cloud, to run things that have better privacy protections, to run things that are provisioned or sliced and diced in different ways, where you might have more agency to that virtual private server, to that virtual machine, to that container, in ways that right now it's simply technically prohibitive for most people to do, and nobody's really built a way for individuals to do that yet. So why can't we have something that is, instead of creating a decentralized world computer, why not just have like your computer, but decentralized? like the apps that you use every day, but they run agnostically in different places. They might be housed in different clouds. They might be from different providers, but kind of, you know, you access it via your front page to quote unquote Web 3.0 or whatever you want to call it. It's in your browser. It runs on top of the operating system of whatever device you're on, but that device at this point is a viewer. Nobody cares if it's a tablet or a phone or a like heavyweight gaming machine. You know, I use my I'm looking at my fancy gaming rig right now next to me, actually. And when I'm not running games on it, it's like glowing different colors. Like it's flashing purple and green right now. Most of the time, it's just loading up like some web tabs, you know, and it's accessing things that are running elsewhere anyway. And, you know, we're not reversing the trend of moving to phones. We're not reversing the trend of moving to cloud. We are hearing more about serverless and about ever increasing kind of SaaS, like everything runs elsewhere. But we can take those things and then modify them slightly so that they're simply less exploitative. And I think we end up with a good outcome.
Yeah, that's interesting. I mean, we, you know, internally on my team, we talk about how the current sort of thin client paradigm is almost like early computers where there was the giant mainframe that you interface into, right?
Yeah.
In some ways, it feels kind of this like anachronistic, like take me back to the Windows 95 era of like a less complicated feedback loop and like less complicated cybernetics.
I mean, I think that the concept, I agree with you, like talking about VPSs feels very kind of like heavy and 90s-ish or 2000s-ish, but that's, you know, they're not a dedicated piece of hardware somewhere anymore. It's a small piece of a much larger pie that is simply like, you know, dynamically provisioned, and these things can be spun up and spun down nearly instantly. You can have you can abstract data from applications and persist data across different data centers. I mean, I think it's really interesting to think of like, you know, this whole ecosystem as potentially being accessible to you, but viewed as one organism. It's kind of the same way that we access the web now. Like you go to a website and maybe, you know, Google keeps trying to make this like homepage of the internet work where they keep putting apps on some home screen that you're supposed to click. But each one that you click is simply accessing a different server somewhere and delivering some content to you. It's like not rocket science. Yeah. So I don't see why this kind of thing doesn't work, other than that it's very hard to make money. It's great for like an open system. You know, I think there was this idea early on that people got about what Clover was doing, that it was some sort of like DeFi app store where we were like approving things and like putting them on a page. And like that is really not, has not ever been a goal of mine. The goal much more broadly is like, we do work with several DeFi projects that are able to launch and help their things become more accessible, but they don't have to ask me to do it. Like it's an open ecosystem. Anybody can publish an index of applications. So like if the Zcash Foundation, which I also work with, like they wanted to put together a list of here's the coolest open source privacy apps. They can just host that index anywhere. And then people can access it and install applications from it. You know, maybe their list differs from the Electronic Frontier Foundation's list. So like that's what decentralization kind of should be. It's the discoverability of all of those that in a privacy preserving way becomes a much larger, big, hairy problem that I'm not right now necessarily trying to solve.
Yeah, the discoverability stuff is quite important.
Yeah. I love web rings. I'm a big fan of like, do you remember Angel Fire web rings from like the 90s where you'd like list your site and be like, oh, I also have a Buffy the Vampire Slayer fan site. So click next to visit this one. Well, before there were yeah, there was no search engines didn't exist. So you would have to like register your site in like a group, like a ring. And then when you were on one of these sites, it would generally point like back or next to the next site in the ring. And that's how people navigated the web.
Oh, right. Yeah, I mean, you talk about sort of like the behavioral modification of surveillance capitalism, yeah. But we forget what it was like behaviorally before there was any design.
Yeah, totally. But I love that idea. I mean, we've seen this rise of like fandoms now. It's like, you know, people are in these like little community niches and it's like super fractal where, you know, no matter how weird you think your tiny little niche is, there's like some subset of it that's even like a little bit stranger and a smaller subset of the people. And And so at a fractal degree, everything becomes a couple dozen web ring sites. I can name on my two hands probably like the websites that I visit about a specific topic, if that's, you know, what's happening in cryptography news or what's happening in Bitcoin news or, you know, what's happening in fiction, like the latest kind of the fiction writers I know. You know, each of those things are microcosms of a larger identity that I have, but there's not more than, I would be hard pressed to name 10 of any of those.
No. Yeah. Let's tug a little bit. I think you just alluded to it on the sort of like parallel selves or digital selves. I think optimistically or pessimistically, like I think we are heading to an era where we'll probably have multiple different types of identities that, like you're saying, are kind of like embedded in these different, I don't know, little like recursive fractal identity structures. Yeah. Where do you see that going?
I hope so. That is the best case scenario, because the opposite idea is that you are one person in all places and everything rolls up to one view of you. And a lot of people will probably die. I mean, not to be too fatalistic about it. I hope that people can present different aspects of their identity in different contexts. It's important, I think, to us as humans to be able to do that. I vehemently disagree with the idea that if you cannot be the same person in all contexts, that you are dishonest. And anybody that doesn't like take off their jacket when they get home, you know, we have to have public and private selves. It's fundamental to our social well-being.
I totally agree with you. And I actually got a lot of hope in looking at the younger generation, you know, like the Gen Z, the Zoomers, like they intrinsically sort of get this, having been online for pretty much their entire lives, you know, these small, subcultures forming on different websites or whatnot. The one that comes to mind is like Instagram and Finstas, and you know, everybody has different alts if you're a kid, and it's natural to them, right? It's more, I think, the millennial generation that feels a little weird about it.
Yeah, I think there's certainly a couple graduating classes in there that got the short end of the stick of public authenticity being like the thing that you should aim for, being, you know, just like let it all hang out. It's cool to be a hot mess and like people need to take it as it is. I hope that we're kind of moving past that to it's okay to have that, but you know, maybe you have that on an alt, because there's something comforting to also having a personal private space and also having some thoughts that maybe don't make it to the internet. Being able to preserve that capacity is probably important to our ongoing mental health as a society. Which is in grave danger in this quarantine, it seems.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. So I guess we talked about it a little bit more, but one thing I want to make sure we come back to is, I guess, what do you think is the legacy of the cypherpunks?
I mean, hopefully it's not a legacy because they're like all dead. I mean, hopefully it's an ongoing journey here. The wide adoption and push of strong cryptography has changed every service and every daily interaction that people have every day. And they don't realize that is underpinning so many of the digital transactions that we have. But it's really a big shift to move from cryptographic algorithms where some piece of the algorithm needed to be kept secret in order for the entire thing to be secure. And therefore you could have like classified algorithms and also intentionally weakened algorithms, which, you know, were subject to attack by whoever held the key. The move from that to having publicly available cryptographic algorithms that are not weaker because you can see the entire thing was just a huge contribution to society and the world at large. And that it is essentially, it's freely accessible, like free as in free speech, but also as in free beer, like anybody can download this, anybody can use this. I think that's the most important part of that legacy. And I think that the idealism and the, you know, I know I've been critical of saying that they've kind of failed in the goal to educate and make everyone care about the impact of that. But that doesn't mean that the contribution was not incredibly important and will continue to, I think, be the foundation of communication forever.
Yeah, I think yes. And I wonder what really is the relationship between, like, let's just say, like, early FOSS culture or like early like crypto communities and like quote unquote crypto now. You know, there sort of are slightly separate areas of concerns, like particularly with the cypherpunks, right, between digital cash projects and privacy preserving tech, right? And there's a lot of overlap there, but certainly in crypto proper, it's much more about digital cash, right? And the supply cap. Do you think something's been lost there?
Such a bummer. I mean, I maintain that crypto stands for Cryptoclitus, the Jurassic era plesiosaur.
Nice.
Yeah. I don't know what to say. I guess I've been a staunch advocate of crypto means cryptography, you know, but I also hate the word cyber. So I'm on the losing fronts of everything. I think that it is an interesting thing to watch the kind of co-option of what was about communication and agency, political impact, and, you know, keeping society free and safe into, hey, did you know we can like make a lot of money with this? Because if you're making money, then you're making money and people are going to be attracted to that. But it, you know, I think that the underlying projects and the underlying interesting technical aspects are so compelling that we still haven't really seen a flight of people, by people I mean like really talented technical contributors. In fact, to the contrary, that like the huge explosion in, you know, blockchain in 2017 and beyond was the largest attractor of talent and funding to some of these projects that, you know, has probably ever happened. There were people working on distributed consensus protocols for like 30 years that nobody cared about. And all of a sudden they're super important, you know, like Rust and Haskell and other kind of like type safe and functional programming projects were like, you know, just, they hadn't really found this kind of anchor. Mm-hmm. There's ever more and more talent. And, you know, it's important that we are attracting, new talent and fresh talent and different talent to be interested in these projects. And that's why it's so important that we make people know that these projects have something to offer them. And that it's not necessarily just about, you know, lend over collateralized money to make some other money and then rinse and repeat. But like the rest of some of these visions is still alive. And, you know, you are an artist on, and right now on Patreon, and you are presenting music that is getting censored for some reason, you're going to get kicked off the platform, or you're creating visual art and you're in a country that doesn't allow you to create or present that kind of visual art, that like accessing an audience and being able to create a living from that is still a very compelling reason to be using a lot of this technology. And the investment stuff is fun too. And I hope that like, not that I wish people to lose money, because I certainly don't, but like people that have like all of this extra money that they're playing with, you know, like that maybe it's just the cost of doing business. It's the cost of innovation, you know, that like we will find out the smart contract was maybe not super secure, like, you know, and maybe it should have been audited, like using your funds. And that was a service to the community. And I really appreciate that. So in that sense, I think that this ongoing, you know, hardening testing that people are constantly doing is super helpful to the ongoing.
Life is just QA.
Yeah.
Life is just QA, yo.
That's a great perspective on DeFi, hardening testing. I like it.
Thank you. Yeah.
just smoke testing.
Mm-hmm.
cool. Well, what haven't we covered here?
Let's see. So I think what we haven't covered, Amber, is you haven't told us about your gaming rig.
I didn't even mean to mention that.
I feel like there's some gamers that might be interested.
It has dual GTX 1070 video cards, which are actually kind of aging now. So it's not super impressive, but it still flashes like green and purple, which is very cool. I have a bunch of like, I went all in on like the Razer Chroma, like keyboard mouse. Like my mouse pad has a charging cable and has to update its own firmware because it flashes LED colors. It's ridiculous. Cool. It's so stupid and I love it. But I will say I did not build this myself. I have done case modding in the past. I created a super cool, like clear acrylic build in like, I don't know, 2001 that I used this like UV spray paint that was clear, but under UV light, it glowed in colors.
And awesome.
Yeah, I stenciled all this art on it and it was in like a clear acrylic case. It was super cool. So I don't do that anymore because once you do that, you're like, I don't have to do this. I can just buy this from Main Gear and it, like, it's the cost of the components, whatever. So that's my gaming computer. And, I recently finished playing Frostpunk. That is the game that I was recently playing.
Oh, would you describe yourself as a Frostpunk?
I mean, honestly, is like punk not a thing anymore because like I'm always surprised that people, in this space and others, but especially in the space where people are challenging dominant paradigms so much that there's not more of a discussion of like, or a sentiment of kill your idols, which is a very like punk phrase kind of thing. It was an album title as well. But that, you know, why do we spend so much time kind of ruminating on people who were here, ages before us? Sure, it's great to recognize kind of the contributions, but it makes us become attached to this sense of reverence for people that often are turning out to not be the type of humans that we want to spearhead as leaders in our community.
Mm-hmm.
And why, you know, kill your idols. Like when you're a writer, you have to kill your darlings, right? Like we need to not be so overly precious with these things. And I think that's just punk, I guess. I don't know. Yeah. But I'll always go with cyberpunk in a pinch. Why not?
I've always felt like the distinguishing feature of, you know, sort of cyberpunk dystopias is it's the same basic structure, like sort of like economic, social, political structures of today, but just sort of amplified by, it's like the technology's new, but the social logic is unchanged.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe a little bit exaggerated.
And the aesthetic is just really shiny.
It's awesome. Yeah.
Yeah. Gotta have a lot of neon. I mean, there was, I think in the foundational kind of cyberpunk literature in your early kind of Gibson and Stevenson and Strauss type novels, there was a sense of, there was a fear of the West being sidelined by like the ascendancy of, at that time, especially Japanese culture in the 80s, which has turned out not to be quite as much as like the ascendancy that we're still replaying that narrative with like China now. But how does that collide with Western sensibilities and what does it look like when the corporation then becomes that ruler? And I think it's still relevant and it's still fascinating. And I hope we get a lot of good new writing. It's time.
Oh, I've got a book for you.
Okay.
Tell you about later. Yeah, it's the best science fiction book I think I've ever read.
I would love to hear about it.
Yeah. So I think it's time to wrap up here. Amber, is there anything else that you'd like to share or plug or talk about before we say goodbye today?
My gosh, I'm so tapped. I feel like you covered everything and more that I could ever even think about.
Cool. But you're still optimistic.
Leading the witness. I think that, you know, I'm not optimistic. I'm never optimistic. I'm extremely cynical about everything, but somewhere in there is the refusal to allow that to be the case. And I guess that means inherently that like, if you have hope that you can change it, that you are optimistic. But no, I mean, I think everything is like, you know, everything has failed. We're probably doomed as a species, but you know, like it'll be fun while we're here. Right.
I think you're hope punk, maybe.
Hope punk.
Oh, that sounds like I could still wear like unicorns and rainbows. I'm down with it. Okay.
Well, Amber, gosh, thanks so much. I know Carolyn and I feel the way, same way. We're, you know, happy to be here with neon arms beside you.
Yeah.
So, thanks so much.
It's so nice to get to talk to, I don't know if I'd say like-minded folks about everything, but it's nice to talk to people who care.